This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Many critics are all agog at the new movie version of the novel Little Women as a retelling of the classic for the modern era. But one Louisa May Alcott scholar says, meh.
But it does so by sacrificing a great deal of the emotional depth of the novel.
ISU professor Roberta Trites dishes about Meg, Jo, and all the rest of the Little Women. Plus, the number of shooting incidents rose significantly in Bloomington Normal last year. Ryan Denham reports on how cannabis expungement works in McLean County. We continue the series Far From Home about housing Illinois special education students out of state and sticking it out in a tough job you really love from a Next to Normal Story Slam. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A legal aid office in Bloomington says it's ready and willing to help people expunge their cannabis convictions or better understand the automatic record clearing process already underway. Ryan Denham has the story.
Even before cannabis got the green light January 1st, Prairie State Legal Services was doing more and more expungement and record sealing work. Over the last 2 years, Prairie State has helped 79 people in McLean County seal or expunge 306 criminal records. Managing attorney Adrian Barr says those records are often the only thing standing in the way of a job or housing.
They're just transformed. They have these barriers that they never thought they could remove to get a job as a CNA or to get a full-time employment or promotion. And then some changes in the law that have happened in the last couple of years, people have been able to remove those barriers and been able to get multiple job offers where they weren't getting any before.
A big part of the state's new cannabis law is righting the wrongs of the drug war, and that means expungement. Minor cannabis arrests will automatically be expunged. Minor cannabis convictions must go through a lengthier process, but that, too, does not require intervention by the person involved. There are about 116,000 records like that statewide, and the Prisoner Review Board is looking them over now. Misdemeanors can be fast-tracked for pardon and expungement, and a list of felonies will be sent to individual counties, like McLean, to give prosecutors a chance to object. That could take months to complete. Barr says individuals have the right to pursue expungement on their own, too, because it's hard to say how long that quasi-automated process will take.
Anyone who's looking for a job this year or even next year would probably be well served to start this process themselves if they think these minor cannabis offenses will be a barrier to their employment.
Individuals might want to seek expungement on their own if they have a more serious conviction, like possessing up to 500 grams of cannabis. They don't qualify for the automated process. There are about 34,000 records statewide in that boat.
Really, what I've found is almost everyone knows someone who has a criminal record.
By the way, the governor's 11,000 pardons last week were all misdemeanor convictions. They're part of that 116,000 statewide that are eligible for expungement, so he's essentially done the first 9% or so of those, and everybody else is waiting. None of those 11,000 were here in McLean County. If you have a cannabis conviction or arrest on your record and are willing to share your expungement story with WGLT, please contact us at news@WGLT.org to be part of a future story. I'm Ryan Denham.
McLean County State's Attorney Don Knapp says he expects to receive a list by February or March of those minor felony convictions that are on track for expungement. He says they just don't know how many cases they will get. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The tally of gun violence in Bloomington Normal last year was even higher than the year before, although fewer people died. Two people were killed, 12 injured by gunfire in Bloomington Normal in 2019, as the number of shootings climbed to 50 for the year. Those 50 shootings are a combination of shots fired incidents or when someone was actually struck by a bullet. Bloomington saw 33 shootings in 2019, up from 15 in 2018. There were 17 more in Normal. Gun violence touched all corners of Bloomington Normal in 2019, from the west side to the east side, near homes, apartments, and businesses. Some blocks were traumatized by repeated incidents.
So we have a crisis.
That's Diane White, co-leader of McLean County's Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America chapter.
And we are committed to fighting this gun violence in all its forms, because Moms Demand Action knows it doesn't have to be this way.
Data from Bloomington and Normal Police show the number of people who were shot but survived in 2019 increased to 12, up from 7 in 2018. The number of fatal shootings fell from 9 in 2018 to 2 in 2019. Here is Bloomington Police Chief Dan Donath.
There's always an ebb and flow to certain things, and so we try to take a look at some patterns that might exist for a little bit longer term in order to see if there truly is a real pattern occurring.
Donath says a fair amount of Bloomington's 33 shootings trace back to hybrid gangs.
There is actually quite a bit of randomness. Some of those shootings are people that weren't from our city, were kind of not on our radar. So there isn't a huge pattern in there, other than, we do have some regular people that we have regular contacts with, that were involved in some of those.
Another contributing factor is social media. Donath says social media has stoked a troubling glorification of guns and violence seen in the young people who post photos of themselves with weapons.
I don't know how much we as a police department can affect that, but the public and society should be mindful of that and try to discourage the culture around guns.
Diane White with Moms Demand Action cites a study from Every Town for Gun Safety that found 58% of adults reported they or someone they care for have experienced gun violence in their lifetime.
I don't personally know these people that were murdered by gun violence in Bloomington Normal, but I have had the honor and privilege of meeting some of their family members. And I will tell you, their stories are unique, but their pain and anguish is sadly similar.
Moms Demand Action supports what it calls common sense gun laws, such as red flag measures and required responsible gun storage. White says they plan to lobby state lawmakers this spring on closing loopholes in the background check system. Except at gun shows, unlicensed gun sellers are not required to conduct background checks in Illinois.
If our legislators are not on board with 87% of the population who do want stronger gun laws, then we need to vote them out.
You can see an interactive map showing every shots fired incident in 2019 in Bloomington Normal at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts, presenting The Drifters on Saturday, January 18th at 7:30. Famous for hits such as Stand By Me, you'll have the opportunity to celebrate their number one singles. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a scholar of Louisa May Alcott looks at the latest film of Little Women. Last year, Illinois amended its school code to limit options for districts sending special needs students out of state. Under the new amendment, districts are no longer able to send students to states that don't provide residential oversight. Some families quickly found a way around the new law. Continuing our week-long series, Far From Home, education reporter Dusty Rhodes explains.
That amendment might as well have been called the Utah Law, because even though the plain language doesn't mention Utah, that's the state it excluded. Stephanie Jones was general counsel for the State Board of Education in 2017, and she helped push through that new law. But today, she acknowledges that families quickly found a workaround. Parents enroll their child in a private facility, pay the cost up front, and then seek reimbursement from the school district. So I had to ask, why would parents want to send kids someplace all the way on the other side of the country and there's no oversight?
That is a fantastic question. I have never understood why, when we've raised issues of, the school doesn't have special education teachers, doesn't have oversight by DCFS, why either parents or hearing officers or parents' attorneys think that they're appropriate placement.
Ted's six-month stay at Discovery Academy in Utah was completely paid for by his parents. He was there as a condition of a plea agreement to get a drug charge dropped in Indiana, which is why 5 years later, he still doesn't want us to use his last name.
When I was packing for there, I was bringing all sorts of things like my lacrosse stick and all my clothes and my cell phone and my wallet and ID, and as soon as I got there, they take everything away. They stripped me completely naked and did a search. No cavity search, but I did do jumping jacks.
Initially, Ted was considered a flight risk.
When I was on run watch and I was sleeping on the floor, there was a kid next to me, and he sliced his neck with this razor in the middle of the night, and I woke up in a pool of blood. I'm like, oh, I'm in some. Like, this is not normal place, you know?
Your mom told me that at one point you called her crying and said, get me out of here, I'd rather just do the jail time.
Yeah, so, no, I said that multiple times, very many times. I still say it today.
Ted was 17 when he was at Discovery, and he says it didn't take him long to realize he needed to play along with the program, even though it meant essentially lying.
I mean, I had this entire pamphlet of me promising my therapy, myself, and my parents that I would never drink alcohol, and I'm not even old enough to drink alcohol right now, you know, but I had to sign this packet and talk about it with my parents in order to graduate the system.
Avital Van Leeuwen found herself at another Utah boarding school, Alpine Academy, in 2011, having been sent there by the Los Angeles School District. Like Ted, she realized there was no escape and resigned herself to playing along.
Actually, one of the most traumatizing parts of being there, I had to stand up in front of everyone and read this speech that they make all of us do called Yes, I'm Getting Better. And I had to like put on this show and this smile of like loving the place and having had a great experience when all I was thinking about was how horrible it was and how much I couldn't wait to get out.
Keegan Autry, who's from Arizona, was one of Van Leeuwen's classmates. To him, the worst part was the use of isolation as a punishment.
You wouldn't be allowed to talk to people, either for a day or up to weeks, if you did something that was quote-unquote bad enough.
The worst thing you could do was kiss a girl, and odds are you'd get caught.
There were cameras in the home. You had no privacy. I didn't even feel safe in my own thoughts. It felt like I wasn't even allowed to think badly of Alpine, and I think that's partially why I started loving Alpine in a way.
For a couple of years after graduation, Autry felt intensely loyal to Alpine, but he says troubling memories kept bubbling up in his mind.
It took a lot of time for it to sink in, like just the depth of how wrong a lot of the things that happened there were.
Looking back, Keegan Autry, and that's now legally his name, realizes he was struggling with gender dysphoria. Alpine is an all-girls school, and since Autry was assigned female at birth, he was expected to behave as a girl. Illinois banned conversion therapy in 2015, but the law does not cover Illinois students residing out of state. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
In an email, the director of Alpine Academy said the school instituted a policy of honoring masculine and non-binary gender pronouns around 2016 and has never had a general policy against masculine dress, though it may have been part of certain students' individual therapy. Dusty Rhodes continues her look at why Illinois sends more than 300 special needs students to private boarding schools out of state. In this next part of the series, Far From Home, she focuses on the transportation service that gets some of them there.
When Avital Van Leeuwen was in 10th grade, she was into skateboarding, punk rock, smoking pot, and feminism. Her home life was in turmoil due to her parents' recent divorce, and even though, or maybe because, she's got a high IQ, she was having problems at school. What she really wanted to do was transfer to a completion program, get her high school diploma, and move on. But that plan got derailed early one morning when she was sitting in bed reading Bitch magazine.
It was pretty typical for me to kind of be up late at that age. And sorry for me to talk about, but I just remember my parents coming into my room out of nowhere, both of them, which was weird. I was at my dad's house. And they said, Avital, we love you very much. And I just knew it was like, it's about to go down. And then these two strangers came in. It was a man and a woman. They didn't really tell me what was happening or where they were taking me. And they told me that
if I resisted in any way that they would restrain me. And they took me in a car to the airport. I remember going through TSA and looking at the TSA agent in the eye and saying, I don't know these people. I'm being kidnapped. And he just laughed.
The TSA agent had probably seen it before. This mode of travel is called therapeutic transport. In the 1970s, it was a way to get addicts to treatment centers. Now, it's also used by behavior modification programs. Ted, now 22, who worked off a drug charge by spending time at a therapeutic boarding school in Utah, says his classmates shared stories about how they got there.
Two big guys would walk in your room in the middle of the night and would zip tie you and throw you in a van and kidnap you pretty much and bring you there. Yeah, a high percentage of kids were brought there like that.
The method was pioneered by a man named Bill Lane. Here he is explaining his techniques to Lon Woodbury, an educational consultant.
We're good people. I mean, we're not there to hurt them. We're not there to threaten them. We're really there to get them safely from home to where they're going.
What happens if the student resists?
You act out at the airport. What we're going to do is rent a car. We're going to drive from New York City direct straight to Utah without stopping. So it gives them some food for thought.
Lane died a few years ago, but the company he founded, Bill Lane and Associates, is still in business and has been used by Illinois school districts to transport students to therapeutic placements. Melissa Taylor, past president of Illinois' Statewide Association of Special Education Administrators, says that company had a vendor table at the group's recent conference.
It has never occurred to me to need a service like that, and it doesn't seem like a healthy way to work with students who probably have experienced some trauma already, but I don't have any firsthand experience there. It just seems very foreign to me.
Some districts are trying a different approach, one aimed at avoiding sending students out of state by teaching parents how to modify their children's behavior at home. James Kling, founder of a firm called Alternative Teaching, provides in-home training plus round-the-clock consultation for a flat fee. Still, he says, he's seen three families use therapeutic transport in the past year.
They've consistently said it was compassionate, it was effective, and they got the kids out. When they thought, uh-oh, it's going to be screaming, yelling, and fighting, and handcuffing kids, which none of that occurs. But, you know, it is, in my opinion, also traumatic to be removed. They did it therapeutically, but in the end, you're not where you're supposed to, and you have now another trauma.
Either service can be included in a student's IEP, or individualized education plan. And whether it's near or far, that means the district pays for that service. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Dusty Rhodes continues her series on special needs students housed out of the state of Illinois tomorrow on 89.1 and WGLT.org. It's called Far From Home.
The Growlers are a fiercely independent band from California who've steadily built a fan base that includes some big names like Dan Arbach, Julian Casablancas, and Ellen DeGeneres. Their music blends lo-fi, surf, and psychedelic into something so unique they came up with their own genre, beach goth. The Growlers shows feel like underground parties, and you are on the guest list. It's The Growlers on the next World Cafe. Listen for World Cafe tonight at 7 on WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for WGLT comes from Forget-Me-Not Flowers, a full-service florist providing quality floral arrangements and plants to the Bloomington Normal area for more than 40 years. Open 6 days a week in Tawanda Plaza. Delivery available at 309-829-1001. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, sticking out in an impossible job, not because of the paycheck, but because it's worth doing. That story in a Next to Normal Story Slam episode in just a few minutes. Many film critics are all agog at the new movie version of the novel Little Women. Audiences, likewise, have been plentiful and appreciative. But Louisa May Alcott scholar and Illinois State University distinguished professor Roberta Trites says meh to the movie as a retelling of the classic for the modern era.
In many ways, it does fulfill that mission, but it does so by sacrificing a great deal of the emotional depth of the novel.
Greta Gerwig is trying to make the Little Women a little more feminist, a little more independent. Even though Jo gets married at the end, she is giving almost a mocking note to that with her behavior with her publisher. How was it really?
In the novel, Alcott also gives a mocking note to Jo's marriage. She didn't want Jo to be married at all, but after book one came out in 1868, she got so much fan mail that her publisher, Mr. Niles, said, "You have to have Jo get married." Well, she refused to marry her off to Lori. That wasn't going to happen. So instead, she created, in her own words, a funny match for Jo, this man who is significantly older than she and who's much kinder than we get to see in this movie.
He's not well developed in this movie.
Many of the characters are not well developed. For example, Marmee is given short shrift. She is the bedrock on which the family life is built, and her daughters almost worship her. They don't want to leave her when they get married. They come to her constantly for advice. She was a very, very strong character based very closely on Alcott's own mother, who was one of the first social workers in Boston. Abba Mae Alcott was an incredible woman, and she's depicted that way in the novel and not so much in the movie.
Is it difficult to give the emotional depth of the novel to a film?
That's the difference between a long form of art like a novel and a short form like a film. Every director who has tried to turn this long form novel into a film has fallen short. Typically, what is sacrificed are some of the plot points. This movie tried so hard to pick up all the plot points that what it missed was the emotional depth of the character's growth.
The length of the scenes was rather short.
Correct.
How much do you lose then?
You lose a lot. There's several scenes, for example, when Meg is really having a difficult time with her twins, Daisy and Demi. She's having a difficult time competing with Sally Moffat. And we don't understand her motivations. We don't understand why everyone loves Beth so much. She just doesn't have enough screen time to be the deeply spiritual presence in the house that she is in the book. And quite a few scenes like that that you just lose. Another example is the pickled lime scene, which is a very famous one. Most people who've read the book, sometimes that's the only thing they remember. Seeing Amy as an adult surrounded by a bunch of little girls makes no sense. And even worse, it's anachronistic for her palms to be ferruled so hard that she's bleeding. It looks more like the teacher whipped her hands than used a ruler. So a combination of not enough depth, because not enough time for the scenes, they would have done far better to cut some of those scenes.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the latest iteration of the movie Little Women. There have been four different movies, including one with Elizabeth Taylor way back when. And we're talking with a Louisa May Alcott scholar, Roberta Trites. The director, Greta Gerwig, has talked about how hard she tried to get it to be historically accurate, working very hard, for instance, on how the food was prepared and preparing dishes not only that were prepared back then, but in the same way. Did you see that attention to historical detail succeed or fail?
On the domestic level, much of it succeeded. On a larger scope, they missed some very key and important historical points that would have been very easy to address. For example, the character who's called Mr. Dashwood, who edits the serial thriller newspaper, The Volcano, is a different person than Mr. Niles, who worked at Roberts Brothers, who edited and asked for the original novel of Little Women. To conflate those two is to say basically the editor of the National Enquirer is the same person as the editor of Atlantic Monthly.
Oh, boy. That's a big difference in tone.
Right, right. The historical accuracy wasn't there with that. They depict a pond across the street from Alcott's house. The picture they have is Orchard House, which is where Alcott wrote Little Women. She had already started to have some financial success as an author, so the family could afford such a large house. She actually wrote it next door in a house called Wayside, which later Nathaniel Hawthorne bought, and it was a much more rundown house. So readers who are aware that the Marches are
poor,
genteel poverty, living in genteel poverty, will understand what's going on with this fancy orchard house that they're living in. But readers who haven't read the book must be thinking, how come these girls keep calling themselves poor with all this
big
house, fancy food, pretty dresses? And most annoyingly, there is no pond across the street from Orchard House.
These sorts of things are going to really bug a historian.
Yes.
They're going to really bug a person like you who's deeply conversant with Alcott's life. What difference, what utility would they have in the movie, though?
I would prefer to see there's easy shortcuts that could have been taken that would have preserved some of the history more accurately. I think it's far more important to get the publishing history correct than to worry about the food. I also have concerns about the violence these girls engage in. That's very anachronistic. They're roughhousing. They're beating each other up. There's a little bit of slapping. As I mentioned, there's the blood on Amy's hands after the teacher scolds her over the pickled limes. It's giving a false sense of what it meant to live in the 19th century.
Is that false for girls of that class or false for any girl in that era?
False for any girl in that era.
What happened usually?
When a girl was punished?
Or when they had spats with their siblings.
Right. I think that girls who engaged in physical fisticuffs would have been shamed so badly for acting in unfeminine, unladylike ways. Now, I can't speak here to the impoverished living in tenements in New York and Boston, but I can say even there, I think it would have been frowned upon.
The speech that was given by one of Joe's sisters about marriage was apparently written by Meryl Streep, and it wasn't originally in there.
Right.
And marriage is an economic proposition. What would Alcott have thought about that?
Two things. First, Aunt March was indeed married. She's a widow. So the fact that she never married changes the tone of the delivery of that particular message. I think Alcott would not necessarily have objected to the idea of marriage as an economic proposition. That was a kind of a widely held belief in the 19th century. The more unusual thing would be marrying for love and knowing you're going to be poor anyway. So Alcott's family was very influenced by the Transcendentalism movement. Bronson Alcott, Louisa's father, was his closest friend was Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Alcott knew Margaret Fuller quite well. Alcott's first novel, called Moods, was about marriage and whether it should be...
I thought her first novel was a ghost story.
Oh, her first novel was Moods.
Okay.
Her very, very first story was actually was a series of fairy tales called Flower Fables. But she did publish thrillers, lots of ghost stories, lots of drug addicts and kidnapped people and women imprisoned in lunatic asylums. And they're really,
yeehaw,
really gory. They're really, really funny from a 21st century perspective. But Margaret Fuller had very strong views about marriage and its inequality for women. Alcott's mother, Abba, lived out much of that. 5 or 10 years into their marriage, her husband never held a full-time job again, and she was the primary wage earner. So I think the cynicism about marriage was captured accurately. It just wasn't resonant when it was coming from someone who is supposed to be a spinster rather than a widow.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the movie Little Women as an adaptation of the great and beloved novel by Louisa May Alcott with Roberta Trites, an Alcott scholar at Illinois State University. Was the movie emotionally satisfying at all?
It would be for many people, yes. I'm not someone who's emotionally satisfied by a lot of children's books that get transformed into movies, partly because that's what literary critics do. We criticize.
We deconstruct them. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Okay. My children used to tease me, have you ever seen a children's movie that you completely liked? And one or two. Shrek was pretty good. But I think it would be emotionally satisfying for people who wanted Joe to be an author first and a wife second.
Would Alcott have recognized or embraced the circular storytelling conventions that Greta Gerwig used? So telling a story backward, telling a story partly in flashbacks and...
No. She was very much... wrote linear narratives. She might have the occasional framed tale where there's a story within the story. And there might be a memory, but she would not have recognized that very postmodern jumping around that was just not a convention in 19th century novel writing.
How does this movie stand up to other Little Women movies?
Well, the 94 version with Susan Sarandon as Marmee overplayed Marmee's feminism. This movie underplayed it. Katharine Hepburn's Joe in the 1930s version was even more raucous and frolicsome and romping around than either the 94 version or the 2019 version. Elizabeth Taylor never worked for me as Amy in the 1940s or 50s version because she's not blonde.
Right.
But it's... all of them fail in different ways. The first three fail in my mind over sacrificing plot to character. This one fails in the exact opposite way. Such a focus on plot, they can't develop the character. But I will give it this one. The 94 version makes me insane because Mr. Bear sells her book manuscript for Joe. Joe doesn't get the pleasure of doing it on her own. She needs a man to do it. And in a movie that's pretending to be this feminist, as the 94 one was, that was absolutely egregious error.
It's a clunker, yeah.
Yeah, it was hugely upsetting. But this time, at least, they let Joe be her own agent in every possible way when it came to her writing.
Okay, this is way too far down in the weeds, but is the 6.5% royalty she finally negotiated or thereabouts, is that accurate for the time?
Yeah, it is. She praised Thomas Niles, her publisher. He offered her $1,000 for the rights, free and clear, which was a lot of money. And she kind of, and he said, really, take the royalty, take the percentage. And she wrote about that incident in her journal. And then later, she penciled in on the side, lucky author, fortunate advice, because she basically became a millionaire for her day based on the sales of book one, Little Women, and book two, Good Wives.
This movie, this latest iteration, will lead some people to the book. Is that a service?
Of course it's a service, Charlie. English professors always want people to read novels. But honestly, it is. Because when people read the book, they will understand better Meg's complexity, Beth's complexity. The movie does a fine job of capturing Amy's complexity. Less so with Joe, honestly. Many critics are saying this is Amy's movie, and I agree with them, but it's Joe's novel. And people who do read the book, and I can't encourage people enough to do so, will find a deep beauty that's very emotionally satisfying that's lacking in the movie.
Roberta Trites, Louisa May Alcott Scholar, Mark Twain Scholar, and English professor, distinguished English professor at Illinois State University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, we got words, lots of words, banned words at the end of the year and the start of 2020. Some people tough it out at a hard job because they need the paycheck. Others stick with the job through the ups and the downs because, well, they wouldn't have it any other way. From the Next to Normal Story Slam, correspondent Brianna Groh brings us a story of a journalist who chose to keep going when the going got tough.
If you're the creative type, a writer, photographer, musician, you know that feeling of pride when you see your name on something you made.
When I wrote my first story, I was 10 years old in elementary school, and it was mimeographed. And once you see your story about the school janitor and your name in purple mimeograph ink, I was hooked.
That's Linda Straw telling her story at the November Next to Normal Story Slam. Straw started her journalism career at the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson.
I worked there my senior year in college by finishing my degree during the day and working at the newspaper from 4 p.m. until midnight. I was rich. I made $100 a week. The main beat for entry-level journalists is always the police beat. And I had a lot of trouble getting the cops to tell me anything as just a college kid, but I probably stewed my own prospects because I was wearing a mini skirt and high heels when I was covering my first highway fatality.
Regardless, the job gave her enough experience to make her next career move.
I picked the Associated Press wire service. I thought it was so prestigious. I could move to the state capital of Phoenix and I would get the title of Arizona State Broadcast Editor. It was not prestigious. I spent the whole time rewriting stories that newspaper reporters had already written. I wrote them in a shorter form and a broadcast style on a manual typewriter, and then I would give them to the telegraph operator, this crusty old gal who'd been doing it for decades, and she would retype the entire story on a strip of yellow paper with little perforations in it. And then the broadcaster who got the story would rip it off the wire. They called broadcasters rip and read artists then. And they would go ahead on the air with the story without even stopping to learn how to pronounce the words. I did that for 1 year, and the only thing I ever covered was a trial about a man accused of killing his girlfriend and dismembering her body. The summer after, I worked for the AP back in Tucson on the night shift. At that time, the main story in Tucson was all the big city mafia bosses had retired in Tucson, and they amused themselves by bombing each other's homes and offices. And I'd spend most of the evening on the phone with the New York AP editors who just didn't believe some of this stuff.
Soon after, Straw met her husband, a U.S. Airman, who was assigned to the Little Rock Air Force Base in Arkansas.
The first thing I thought of was my dad driving the family station wagon through Arkansas and saying, "This is hillbilly heaven." But as soon as we got there, I was hired pretty quickly by the evening newspaper, which was called the Arkansas Democrat. And Arkansas Little Rock was very much like Bloomington Normal. There were actually two separate cities, Little Rock on one side of the river and North Little Rock on the other side of the river. They'd never paid much attention to North Little Rock, but they sent me over there to be the City Hall reporter.
When she arrived, Straw learned the city was run by Mayor William F. Lehman. Mayor Lehman, or Casey, as he was called, had run the city for the last 12 years without any reporter to look closely at his doings.
He'd appointed his son-in-law as the city attorney, He paid for all the city furniture from his own furniture store without any bids. And he wasn't used to having these things in the newspaper, so I started quoting him on things and reporting some of these things, and he was really, really unhappy about it. There was one occasion when he went to California to a big municipal mayor's convention, and he took his friend, a city commissioner named John Blodgett, with him. Well, when they got back, I noticed the expense account, the money spent on that trip, was just outrageous. So I called up Mr. Blodgett and I said, "Well, what all did you do in California?" "Oh," he said, "we rented a beachside condo and we didn't go to the convention hotel. And we played golf and we went to bars and we had great food. It was just the most wonderful vacation." So after I got that in the newspaper, the mayor locked up my office. It was just a desk and a typewriter under the staircase in City Hall. But he put a lock on it, and then he told all the city employees not to speak to me. So I'm literally out on the sidewalk now trying to cover this city.
That hardly mattered, though. The sidewalk was exactly where Straw found the mayor and her next story.
There was an X-rated movie theater, and it opened one block from City Hall. So he hurriedly got a new law passed that pornography could not be allowed, especially in a filming situation, in the city. Then he got the public works crew out there, and he built a chain link fence right in front of the theater, right up against the front wall of the theater, about an inch away maybe. So nobody could get between the fence and the box office to buy a ticket. So then the theater owners filed suit and we all went to court on this. Well, the judge decided that he and the jury need to see at least six of these films to judge whether they were pornographic. So he had his bailiff carry the U.S. flag out of the courtroom. He didn't want the flag exposed to this. And then as soon as the lights went out, it seemed like all the courthouse employees would lock their offices and come in to watch. It was standing room only, I'm telling you.
After 2 years covering the various foibles of the mayor and city council members, Straw published her first big story.
A big discount store, I think it was Kmart, that was going to be built on city land. And it involved a whole lot of bribes and the city attorney relative, et cetera, et cetera. Tires were slashed on my car. The brake line was cut. And I got an anonymous letter that I could get a real story about things if only I came late at night alone to a dam over the river. Well, I stayed home.
After 14 years as mayor, Casey decided not to run for re-election.
The next mayor was named Bob Roseman. He spent the night of the election tearing around town in a fire truck with a siren going. He resigned in a year because he was indicted for something. So at that point, I thought, I just need to call my dad and say he was right on talking about these hillbillies.
Straw says even with everything that happened in that little town, she really did enjoy her time as a reporter in Arkansas.
I always wanted to be a journalist, and I really enjoyed every minute of it. I think my passion is just telling other people's stories. And then when I found so much corruption in politics, I just wanted to make things right by reporting what was going on.
And in response to that, you got a lot of pushback and I would say harassment. So how did you find the wherewithal to continue in the business through that?
Well, I just loved what I was doing, and I didn't have any children. I didn't have any one to protect other than myself. So I just carried on.
Strauss says she did eventually settle into a more tame work environment.
I did work for 18 years at Champaign. I did a wide variety of things there. I wrote columns. I wrote about the schools. I wrote about religion. I learned a lot as I was going on. And, there was a time when I was writing three different columns and store feature stories that I felt very, very secure and happy in what I was doing. No major threats or gory trials.
But that happiness and security couldn't last forever. With the rise of the internet and digital technology came sweeping changes in the industry.
There were many, many layoffs at my newspaper in Champaign, and the Arkansas newspaper where I worked is now going to go completely digital. The owner has bought practically everyone in the state of Arkansas an iPad and is giving classes. And from now, I hear about this from my old friends, and it's just kind of sad to think you won't have a newspaper with the morning coffee anymore. You'll have to do it all through technology.
Straw retired from journalism in 2011, but that hasn't changed her identity as a writer. She stays active in community theater, writing plays, and submits stories for the neighborhood magazine. And while life is much more tame for Straw these days, she says she's still pursuing her passion, writing about people. I'm Brianna Grow.
The next Normal Story Slam returns to the McLean County Arts Center January 17th with the theme, Aha, Eureka, I've Got It. Storytelling begins at 7:30 p.m. on the 17th, and you can listen to full episodes of GLT's Next Normal Story Slam podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org. Politics, television, and social media were once again rich sources for abuse of the English language in the last year, and they're the main contributors to the latest words and phrases banished from the Queen's English for misuse, overuse, and general uselessness. Herb Trix has more.
The 2019 banished list is the 45th to be issued by Lake Superior State University in Michigan. In past years, it was overseen by the Public Relations Office, but this year it became the responsibility of the English Department. Mary McMinn is an associate professor of English and creative writing and a member of the Banished Word Committee.
I think that the list serves a really interesting role. There are a lot of organizations nationwide that nominate a word of the year, like the Merriam-Webster Dictionary does one, the Association of Linguists does one, but they just nominate one word of the year, and it's sort of like experts nominating that. And this list, as far as I know, is the only list where the American populace can actually nominate words. So it's a way for people to be word watchers themselves and then sort of keep an eye on the language.
And the winner, she says, hands down with the most nominations, is the phrase quid pro quo.
In Latin, it just means something for something. And it actually comes, the first reported instance of the phrase is actually all the way back in the 16th century. So it started with apothecaries when they would substitute one medication for another. Sometimes they would intentionally substitute them, but another times they would fraudulently substitute one medication for another. And as the years passed, it started to be any substitution of one thing for another. And then it started to have the negative connotation that we have with the word, with the phrase now, where it sort of means pay for play.
From the pretentious section of the list comes the word artisanal, which appears on a lot of menus these days, trying to make your water or salad dressing or sandwich sound more exciting. And from the explosion of foodie shows and sites comes mouthfeel.
That was one that surprised me too. But basically, it's the word that is used to describe the texture of a food in your mouth. But texture isn't good enough. You have to say mouthfeel, which is kind of gross because, where else are you going to put your food? Are we going to talk about foot feel or hand feel?
And then there's literally.
The word literally means, it's a synonym for actually, right? And the way that it has been changing over the years is to act, is it actually has become its own antonym. So instead of meaning actually, people are using it for emphasis or for figurative. So I could say, I was so surprised my head literally exploded, which would mean that my head actually exploded, but people are using it for emphasis, meaning that my head almost exploded, or for figurative. So it's a very interesting word that it's become to mean its opposite.
And we thank Herb Trix literally for his list of banned words report. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham and correspondent Brianna Groh. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.